Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 20th already of May. This hour of the program, we have three guests to talk about the important races and ask the question whether they mean anything in terms of what will happen with the midterm elections. We'll be talking about Pennsylvania races, in not only the Arlen Specter loss, but also we'll be looking at the, well, it's going to happen today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi will be swearing in Pennsylvania Democrat Mark Critz as the newest member of the House of Representatives. That's Murtha's seat, special election there, and the Democrat did win. Is that meaningful? We'll be also looking at what went on in Kentucky with this huge win by Rand Paul and learn a little bit more about him. And we'll go to Arkansas, where Blanche Lincoln will now face a runoff election. And our guest says she is surprised that the people who were supposed to vote a certain way did not do that. What does that mean? Well, welcome your phone calls all hour, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use one of those, is talk@wpr.org. And we start with Thomas Fitzgerald, staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Hello, Thomas. Thanks so much for being with us. Hi.
My pleasure.
Yeah, great to have you here. So did you feel that Specter was going to lose this, or was this an upset?
In the final days, based on tracking poll trends, it felt pretty clear what was going to happen. And then the day dawned all wet and cold, kind of like a March day, and it felt like he was going to lose. But at the same time, it was an upset because Arlen Specter had been such a part of politics and public life in this state for, 55 years, going back to when he was an assistant DA in Philadelphia, that it just seemed, and he had so many near misses in elections that people had almost this mystical idea about him that Arlen Specter could not be killed. And so it was, like, stunning, but I guess not surprising.
Yeah.
It was emotionally weird for a lot of people, but it seemed pretty clear he was going to pay the price for his party change.
And what did anything have to do with the fact that he is 80 years old now and there comes a time for a change of the guard?
Yes. And in fact, that was definitely a motif running through his challenger's campaign, although they did it in not very hidden code, but politely enough. And it was amazing how unbidden, in interviewing over this campaign, tons of voters, it was amazing how unbidden so many of them would bring up that I just think Arlen Specter's too old. He's been around too long. And I heard that most from people who were above 70.
Oh, my goodness.
Who said, I just really don't think it's right for him to keep hanging on. And I know, I know what it's like to be over 70. And Specter's, is 80. He's survived several health problems, two Hodgkin's disease bouts, a brain tumor, heart problems. He's a tough guy.
He is a tough guy.
And he's very vital. But people, I think that was a factor for people. Just even if they thought it was ageist to suggest he couldn't handle the job, a lot of people believed, 30 years is a generation he'd been a senator. So maybe it was time for something else. And then Joe Sestak, the congressman who beat Specter, stoked that because his ads would talk about, new generation, new blood, energy, using words like that, as he did on the stump also. And he'd say things like, I respect Senator Specter for his long service to the nation. it got kind of heated at the end when one of his ads used pictures of Arlen Specter from a few years back after he had undergone chemotherapy.
Oh.
And used him in black and white and ads, and he looked hideous.
Oh.
His family was, Arnold Spector's family was quite offended.
And tell me a little bit more about Joe Sestak. Where do you put him on the political spectrum?
Well, Joe Sestak, because he was leaning against Spector, the former Republican, he sort of got a reputation as a liberal. And indeed, like a lot of his early support came from Netroots folks, former DNIACs, you know, Daily Kos, do money bombs, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he really, I'd say he was to the left of Arlen Specter, for sure. But I'd say he's really probably pretty much of a pragmatic centrist guy. He's not as liberal as he comes across. I mean, he was a military man for 31 years, Navy admiral. So he has like a very realistic view of the need to sometimes use military force. In fact, liberals really soured on him when, you know, in a role reversal, Spector opposed the escalation in Afghanistan. And Sestak supported it, and in fact, like his web-based donations sort of dried to a trickle for a while after that.
And was that part of the campaign, Thomas?
It wasn't a huge issue, you know, Frank. This campaign was mostly about character. You know, Spector, in Sestak's view, was, you know, couldn't be trusted, no core principles, willing to switch his party to save his butt.
Mm-hmm.
And Sestak, Spector, people talked about how he had missed a lot of votes in the House and how he pays his campaign workers less than the minimum wage, which is actually true. Unclear whether it's a legal violation or there's some gray area for campaign workers, but clearly people didn't care about those kind of attacks. And then there was also kind of cloudy circumstances under which Sestak lost one Navy job near the end of his career. He was like a number two in the Navy up in the Pentagon, and a new top admiral removed him, and news reports at the time in 2005 said he had created a poor command climate, which essentially means he was really nasty to his people and they complained. Mr. Spector tried to make an issue of that too. It didn't really seem to take. I mean, voters perhaps didn't see the relevance, and the Sestak folks were really aggressive about, you know, sounding the alarm that they thought they were being swift voted, you know, going back to that 2004 right. episode against John Kerry. And it really wasn't that, but the whole thing, it didn't really take either. And so it became new guy versus guy who'd been around a long time and had done great things for the state in terms of the old-fashioned dams. Bridges,
sure.
Clinics, hospital additions, dredging of the Delaware River port, which is really important to Philadelphia's economic future, getting the federal money to do that. You know, pork. What people that aren't from Pennsylvania would call pork.
Right.
Versus some guy who said, I resent the way the White House and everybody else tried to anoint this guy who was in the other party. He's not one of us. And we got to stop all the deal making and the way of doing business in Washington. And that was more appealing to folks in the Democratic primary.
Was Spector feeling abandoned by the administration when they didn't come and really stump for him at the end?
Yes. Now, he, of course, thanked the president and the administration profusely for all they had done for him. But they did kind of stab him in the back. It's hard to escape that conclusion, and I think it chafed. For the president, flew to Youngstown, Ohio, on the day of the primary and went 22,000 feet above Pittsburgh
Goodness.
While the polls were open. And he mentioned nothing. And Youngstown is, I don't know, 15, 20 miles from the line. Mr. Vice President Biden, who is a dear friend of Arlen Specter's, they, you know, since Biden's from Wilmington, Specter from Philadelphia, both easy train rides from D.C. For 3 decades, they were like train partners. And Biden was at the University of Pennsylvania on the day before the election, speaking at a commencement for one of for the social work school from which his daughter was graduating, and he didn't do an event for Specter. It was as if they had written him off. I mean, the White House, you know, off the record of, you know, not for attribution, of course, had said they thought Specter was a goner.
You would have thought, and I'm wondering what was going through Biden's mind, that he would have stepped in there, considering that long association. That's a lot of years to ride the train together.
I would have thought so, too.
Yeah. Let's just touch briefly, because he will be given the oath of office this afternoon. What about the race for Jack Murtha's seat? Did the Republicans think they could pick that up?
Oh, they really did.
Really?
They're kind of, if they're... They're really doing a lot of soul searching. It's if there was any district anywhere that Republicans should have had a chance for a pickup, especially in this kind of climate, it would be there. It's a very socially conservative area. It's got a Democratic registration advantage, but these are Democrats who tend to be pro-life and members of the NRA, and not your San Francisco or Philadelphia Democrats. So. They had a chance, and the district voted for John McCain. It was the only district in the United States that went in 2004 for John Kerry, the Democrat, for president, and in 2008 went for McCain. So it seemed a hospitable district. What I understand about that, though, is that the Republicans just completely nationalized the race and talked a lot of generalities about Nancy Pelosi and, you know, the Obama-Pelosi agenda and stopping Washington overreach. And there was even an ad they had called Attack of the 50-Foot Nancy Pelosi, you know, like she was some kind of monster.
Oh, my.
The guy, and they used lasers to bring her down.
Oh, no. Know.
Yeah, it's online. But the Democrat talked about local stuff. How Johnstown is like the city that's most associated with the district. How, you know, how poor it was. How its economy is so shaky. And how it needs jobs. And what he wanted to do about that. And his association with Mr. Murtha, who was revered, helped too. Murtha brought so much to that district. I mean, if you go down there, there were amazing high-tech defense contractors, because Murtha was in charge of the appropriations subcommittee that passed out passed on military spending. So there's an awful lot of economic growth. Whatever economic growth there is could be attributed to Murtha. So people, though they, you know, would seem to be amenable to the Republican message, people in that district didn't really think the government was all that evil. After all, it had been helping them survive what's been brutal times since steel manufacturing really collapsed, and, you know, and during the struggles of coal mining.
So can you take a message, or is this too broad, that to win in the midterms, you really need to keep it pretty local?
Yeah, that might be too broad, I think so, especially in the special election. It seems that way. I mean, there's really no two ways about it, that in this case, that's what that's what won it for the Democrats. That's how they people were surprised by that one.
And who does Sestak face in the midterms?
It will be Pat Toomey, who is a former congressman who term limited himself. He is from the Allentown area in north, you know, kind of eastern Pennsylvania, but north of Philly. And he's a fiscal conservative. He, you know, had been a he left after his third term to run against Arlen Specter when Specter was a Republican in their 2004 primary. And he almost knocked Specter off then because, of course, conservatives never liked Specter and never believed he represented them. He was a true cantankerous, independent guy.
Right.
And would, you know, irritate people right and left. And Toomey also could take credit for knocking Specter off this year in a way. He was, after Specter voted for the stimulus in February 2009, Toomey abandoned a planned run for governor and decided to challenge Specter in the Republican primary again, and Specter switched thereafter to the Democrats. Now, and Toomey also was head of the Club for Growth, which is a low-tax, anti-regulation advocacy group that's funded by basically the financial industry. And he is a former Wall Street trader back in his youth. So there's going to be a whole, you know, a whole attack on that aspect. You know, he's a true free trader guy, you know, no low taxes, no regulation. Bush tax cuts were fine. We need to cut capital gains tax. Stop spending so much money. You know, classic
right.
stuff that people, that could tap really into concerns people have about the debt.
Thomas, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate all your analysis.
My pleasure, Kathleen. I hope it helped.
Yes, it did. Thanks. Okay. Thomas Fitzgerald, staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, talking about Arlen Specter going down and also about the special election for the seat that was vacated because Jack Murtha passed away. We're going to continue our conversation here. We have three guests this hour because there were three important parts of the country that everybody was looking at. Jeanine Perry will be joining us momentarily, director of the Arkansas Poll and political scientist at the University of Arkansas. So that's coming up here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to Arkansas for our next conversation with Professor Jeanine Perry. She's an associate professor and director of the Arkansas Poll, worked as a legislative aide in the Washington State Senate, and served as a graduate fellow in the office of former Speaker of the House Thomas Foley in 1993. In this race, as you probably know, there will be a runoff. And what happened here is that the candidates, Blanche Lincoln is the incumbent, and Lieutenant Governor Bill Halter, who's back on the trail this week, trying to oust Blanche Lincoln in the June 8th runoff. Unofficial returns from the Arkansas Secretary of State's office showed Lincoln with an edge of less than 5,000 votes out of 280,000 cast. Neither candidate approached the 50% needed to avoid a runoff. Our guest this hour said that he did, speaking about Halter, better. He did well where he shouldn't have. I am stunned, and she will talk more about that. Professor Jeanine Perry, thank you very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Did this look like it was going to be very, very close, or again, did Blanche Lincoln really have the upper hand because of her national prominence, her time served, or was this going to be a difficult race for her?
Well, the one thing I can sort of speak to is that the polls leading up to the election showed Halter, on average, to be about 10 points back behind her. And then in addition, the polls fairly consistently showed there was another candidate in the race, of course, D.C. Morrison. And they showed him, you know, he's an unknown, inexperienced, a very poorly financed candidate, showed him in single digits. But as it turned out, of course, Halter came very close to her, as you've just indicated. It looks like it might be either 45-43 or 44-43. In the final count. And D.C. Morrison ended up pulling 13% of the Democratic electorate vote. So there certainly, I think, were surprises in there in several ways.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the political slant, the issues that are important to Halter.
It's rather hard to tell. He's done really a masterful job of looking, I think, at the Arkansas electorate and reading the tea leaves about the anti-Washington mood, and also knowing that where his base of support originally came from, which was very publicly and actively from AFL-CIO, they were frustrated with her, and also from the national progressive group MoveOn.org. And I think he and his campaign knew that that wouldn't play particularly well, even in a Democratic primary in Arkansas, much less the general. So he did a good job of largely distancing himself from those early supporters and the folks who composed the bulk of the money on his side, and just talking about sort of hitting the Washington is broken theme, banging that anti-Beltway drum. He did say, you know, so he wouldn't say specifically, you know, what he would have done on the card check proposal with, you know, for which she got in so much hot water with the unions. He did say that he was basically for a public option, which she eventually came out very publicly against, while she lent the Democratic majority some key procedural votes to move health care reform generally forward. But other than that, he has stayed away from making policy commitments and has just played this additional changes needed theme.
Hmm. And how about Morrison?
Morrison, in all ways except one, actually, had a message that got out there more than it would have otherwise, because there was some thought that he might play sort of a spoiler role in the sense that he might take this into a runoff, and indeed he played a significant role in doing that in the end. So the message that got out there was more than usually does, right, for a so-called minor candidate. But almost everything he said seemed much more in keeping with the planks of the Republican Party than the Democratic one. He said he can't remember the last time he himself voted for a Democrat. He thought we should repeal the national health care legislation and a number of other ideas that are, you know, more traditionally aligned with the Republican Party. So he was an interesting puzzle in this whole process.
So that vote is more likely to go to Lincoln?
I think that on the surface, and if the ideological spectrum mattered in the way that you and I might think or hope that it would, that would make sense. That those would be the more conservative Democratic voters, or they're really independents who were pulled into the Democratic primary. And those votes should naturally gravitate to Lincoln, who's seen certainly as the centrist in the race, given, you know, where Halter's support originally came from, even though we're not totally sure about his policy positions. But it's on the other hand, because Halter's support came from places you wouldn't expect it to, I am really beginning to wonder if some of those Morrison voters don't actually end up gravitating to Halter as simply the anti-Washington, anti-Blanche Lincoln candidate.
Hmm. Well, you can't get through an election of this significance without saying what your positions are on important issues, can you?
Well, it appears that you can at least make a stronger than expected and showing and hold a powerful incumbent to significantly less than the 50% she needed to move on as the party's nominee. He, I should say too, he's certainly well known for being connected to education and funding for college scholarships in particular. You know, I think you may have mentioned that he is most publicly known not for what he does as lieutenant governor, which, as in most states, is, you know, sort of a good time Charlie position, but for publicly, actively, and successfully backing a statewide constitutional initiative to adopt a lottery to pay for college scholarships in Arkansas. And so, you know, that's certainly a theme that he hit pretty hard. It's not really a national policy theme, but it's something it's hard to quibble with in a state like Arkansas, which has such low educational attainment rates, you can, of course, contend that it's a tax on the poor to pay for college tuition for middle-class kids. But, you know, that's a kind of a sophisticated, I think, ideological analysis. And I think, you know, voters approved it by a fairly strong margin in 2008. And I think that he's ridden that wave with some success together with the anti-Washington message.
Yeah. Let's talk more about that anti-Washington message. We were concentrating on Pennsylvania the first 20 minutes of the program and looking mostly at Specter, but also at the special election for Murtha's seat. And our guest was saying that the candidate who was anti-Washington, the Republican, had a very generalized anti-Washington, anti-Pelosi, et cetera, message, and it just didn't cut it. And the conversation was much more local, and Murtha was beloved for all that he brought to that particular district. And you're saying something different, that the anti-Washington message really played in Arkansas. So what's the story?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, on the one hand, it did play well. On the other hand, it didn't. I mean, in the not playing well or not being significant, you know, Halter's very candidacy was born out of the allies of the national left who were frustrated.
Right.
The centrists like Blanche Lincoln were slowing down the change train.
Mm-hmm.
So it really, his candidacy began, it would not exist if it hadn't been sort of for this ideological purge. You know, it wasn't anything close to throw the rascals out. But then it appears when you look at the results on a county-by-county basis that these white rural swing voters who voted disproportionately, even in Arkansas, for John McCain in 2008, it's as if they didn't get the memo, and they ended up voting for this union and MoveOn.org back candidate who is presumably an ideological mismatch for them. So the beginning would suggest it wasn't at all a Washington backlash, but the end result suggests that it partly was a Washington backlash. And then I think you can also look at, and this has been somewhat overlooked, but I think it's quite interesting and puzzling, on the Republican side, it was well known nationwide and in the state that Blanche Lincoln was a vulnerable incumbent, that it might be the Republican Party's first chance to pick off that particular Senate seat from Arkansas for the first time since Reconstruction. So an eight-way field developed. And yet, one man emerged from that field without the need for a runoff, and that one man is the one with the most significant Washington, D.C. experience. And you would sort of expect that anti-Washington, and right now that would be anti-Democrat mood, the sort of Tea Party-affiliated folks, would have been more active and louder on the Republican side, and yet you see exactly the opposite of that on in the Republican primary in Arkansas, which I think is fascinating.
It is fascinating. This whole thing kind of makes it up for grabs in a way. I can see why you were stunned.
I was. You know, it's these wild and woolly Arkansas voters. We were split ticket voting before split ticket voting was cool, and you have these really quite conservative, heavily rural, heavily white counties that run. My predecessor, a wonderful scholar named Diane Blair, she identified them in the 80s as basically running from the southwest corner of the state around Little Rock, which is Pulaski County, and then up into the northeast corner. And she identified them as the swing voters, and they make or break statewide elections in Arkansas, and they can swing one election heavily to the right. You know, they have given tremendous support in recent past presidential elections to the Republican candidate, but they are just as comfortable voting, say, for our incumbent governor, who's attracted only a weak Republican challenger this year. They're very comfortable in Beebe's camp as well, and he's a longtime Democrat. So those are the folks that we're trying to predict, and that may be trying to predict the unpredictable.
Yeah. Our number is 800-486-8655 in case you'd like to join any part of our conversation this morning. 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@WPR.org. WPR.org. How long has Blanche Lincoln been in office?
It's interesting. She actually is just finishing up her second term. Mm. She was originally elected to the U.S. Senate in 1998, though she had served, I think, two terms in the House from the Northeastern House District, the first congressional district of Arkansas, earlier than that. And, of course, she recently ascended to chair the Senate Agriculture Committee, which I think is another surprise here. You'd think that a lot of those white rural voters would have been attracted to that position and to her potential to help Arkansas in that position. And, in fact, she released what I thought would have been a very effective ad called 184, which shows a farmer, you know, moving around bales and doing farm things. You can tell I'm a city girl. But he's, you know, he says, we've waited, Arkansas has waited 184 years basically to get its due. And, you know, why would we give that up? And that's why I said in several other, you know, national print articles that she really did not have the support where she should have. And Halter seemed to get the support where you wouldn't have expected it.
Let's go to a call. Carl from Madison. Hi, Carl.
Hi. This is a digression here. Hey, most people under 30 say hey. They don't say hello or howdy, and I think your guest as a college professor would agree. What my basic question is how, to what extent did Blanche Lincoln's vote against the regulation of derivatives and a lot of the other financial reforms? She's been very resistant to that. She seems much more in the Republican camp on those issues. And I think that a lot of the resistance is not to Washington. I think a lot of it is to Wall Street.
I think that's a very interesting point, but you actually have it reversed. And it wouldn't, to be fair, it wouldn't have happened if Bill Halter hadn't run this you know, insurgent candidacy that many thought was from the left. I guess everyone except the voters thought was from the left. She actually came out much more strongly in the end. There was a surprise turn of events just a few weeks back where she pitched a proposal to regulate the derivatives market in a way that was considered too strong even by a lot of folks in the Democratic leadership in Congress. So that was the one way in which, as a result of this primary challenge, she ended up moving left. On almost everything else, she either stayed in the center or actually moved right, I think, you know, having to sort of position herself for a tough general election battle. So, and in that sense, I really thought that derivatives were the one thing that could have and may still serve her well in the primary and in the general. In the primary, I think it gave some liberals and progressives here who were frustrated with her pause to say, okay, well, maybe she's not all that bad. She's willing to take on the large financial institutions. And, of course, that same theme speaks well to a lot of these rural, fairly conservative independents who don't like big institutions, especially ones that cause major financial downfalls. And then, of course, in the general, I think it would have played well again, because most Arkansas voters in the general tend to, you know, be anti-establishment and certainly anti-Wall Street. So I think that's a really good point to raise, and she sent some signals that she was going to do what you suggest, but in the end, she actually moved way left on derivatives.
Hmm.
Right, but originally she was strongly against the regulation, and I love to be proved wrong, by the way.
Well, I'd love to do it.
On a lot of the reforms on Wall Street?
She was. It was perceived that the signals that she was sending was that she was going to walk this very narrow line. It was going in the middle. She was, you know, crafting a compromise that would be very narrowly tailored. And she talked about sort of this surgical approach with one of her Republican colleagues. And then she abandoned all of that, much to everyone's surprise and I think Halter's frustration, and moved way left. Now, I think there was some safety, and there's been a lot of conversation about that this likely was a calculation on her part, that it really was sort of risk-free in the sense that the Democratic leadership and the Republicans they need to get on board weren't going to let it happen anyway. So she would get the credit for trying, and she could, you know, get points for that in Arkansas. In the meantime, the whole thing, of course, is shut down in Washington, D.C. until this primary is over. But we probably aren't going to end up with a stronger proposal as she pitched in the end anyway.
Thanks so much, Carl, for your call. And thank you. Any predictions of where this is going on June 8th, Professor Perry?
You know, I am hard pressed to say. I'm thinking that the agricultural appeal and her effort to sort of out Arkansas the lieutenant governor, who was away for some time, doing business and educational things, and is come back so eager to get into politics and make a difference for the state. I thought that that might win the day, but this anti-Washington theme proved to be much stronger than I anticipated.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Professor Jeanine Perry with us to analyze the Arkansas race, associate professor and director of the Arkansas Poll. She's at the University of Arkansas. We thank her for her time. We're going to continue now and go to Kentucky. We'll take a look at Rand Paul, who won that race by many, many miles. So we will continue our conversation and go to Kentucky next. And welcome your phone calls. You're welcome to join us. I know we're covering a lot of territory here, but you may have some general statements, too, about what you learned or any significance that you thought there was to all of the races that took place. Are we overanalyzing these, or is it a case, as Donna Brazil said, that the far right and the far left are ascendant in both parties? The extremes of the spectrum made gains in each party's primaries against the all things to all people incumbents. 800-486-8655, the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kentucky next, and we speak with Professor Stephen Voss, Associate Professor, Director of Undergraduate Studies, political science at the University of Kentucky. This, of course, is the race where Rand Paul won, and descriptions are that his win wasn't just big, it was massive. Our phone number again, 800-486-8655. Professor Stephen Voss, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Not at all. Good morning, Kathleen.
Yeah. So Rand Paul, massive victory, would you say? Professor Voss?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, would you say that this was a massive victory for Rand Paul?
Well, sure. I mean, he was running against an establishment candidate with lots of money, with experience, and no scandal or anything that in his record. And to trounce him that way with no prior electoral experience was amazing. That doesn't happen very often in American politics.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more. We all find him fascinating now because of his death.
I'm sorry. Our sound keeps cutting out. I keep losing you.
All right. Hold on a second. We'll try and get you on another line then. I'm not sure what the problem is here. And continue. Well, my line is cutting out on him, so he can't hear us. So we're trying to get him on another line as we continue as we really almost start our conversation about what happened in Kentucky, where he, of course, thanked the Tea Party for their support. And we'll ask the question whether or not it was instrumental in helping him to achieve his victory. He has a very interesting background, too. He's a surgeon, and this is his first race, is my understanding, so we will talk about that as well. Can you hear me now, Professor Voss? Hello?
It's a very faint signal. I'm sorry, Kathleen.
Oh, dear. I'm sorry. We'll put you on another line because we have to be able to hear you, so I'm not sure why. The second hour of our program today, we will be talking with a gentleman who decided to circumnavigate the world and never go by airplane. So we will talk about that with the author of a book on that in a moment. We can take a call until we get the phone thing worked out here. Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike. We don't have a guest yet, but hello, Mike. Go ahead.
Okay, here I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
All right. No, I don't know what the word is, delighted, very happy to see Arlen Specter out. I think, you know, in the campaign and the switch of parties, it was just so absolutely self-serving that I think we're better off without him there.
He was self-serving?
Don't you think so?
He changed parties in order to win re-election.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like he said, you know. Yeah, I'm searching parties to be reelected.
Mm-hmm.
That's astonishing.
And what do you think of the CESTEC? And what do you think all of these elections mean, if anything?
Well, I think that there's a lot of discontent out there. I think people are angry. They're you know, they're striking out against the, you know, available targets. The available targets are the people who are in, you know, in office. And, you know, I don't know. I think the mood of the country is really, really, really bad. This, you know, with this thing in Arizona, things that are going on around the world. Was it just this morning that we heard that, you know, North Korea had torpedoed that that South Korean, you know, that South Korean ship? You know, what's going to happen there? Stock market keeps on going down. I don't know. Doesn't look good to me.
Okay, thanks, Mike, very much for the call. Professor Voss, can you hear us now?
I sure can, Kathleen.
I don't know what the heck the problem was. Okay, thank you very much for being with us. We were trying to get a little more background information on Rand Paul. He's a surgeon, isn't he?
He is. He comes from a medical background. He had no prior elected official experience, but of course his father has run for president more than once, and he did have more experience on the campaign trail than you normally would see from a quote citizen politician close quote of that sort.
Mm-hmm. And was there a lot of money, a lot of endorsement in this race from the standard bearers of the Republican Party right now? Mitch McConnell, we've read a lot about his support for Grayson. It wasn't enough, obviously. What does that signify?
Well, you know, early on, a lot of Paul's money came from outside the state. And people who dismissed his campaign said, you know, it doesn't matter how much money you raise because your support out in these money-raising places doesn't mean you can win Kentucky votes. The fact that he was able to take that money and convert it into votes among all these Republican primary voters, you know, was impressive, and it shows you the limits of the sort of old-time political machine politics when you've got the money to get your message directly to voters.
Mm-hmm. And what about Tea Party activists? Obviously, there were many who voted for him. Were there a number of people who came in from Tea Party organizations to support him, to give him money? Did he have to count on that group to put him over the top?
Certainly, that early money from the Tea Party associated people was big. I don't know that he really got that much of his activist core. I mean, I'm not inside the campaign, but from my end, it looked as though that these were homegrown activists in large number. Certainly, for example, on the University of Kentucky campus, the prominent people who were working for him were, you know, students of ours.
Were students? Why?
Well, I mean, it's on campus. They usually, when you're trying to communicate with students, you go through student leaders and then come in and give talks yourself, you know.
And did he have big support on campus?
He did. You know, there was a lot of enthusiasm for him. I wouldn't say it was overwhelmingly one-sided. I you know, a lot of our Republican students were for Grayson as well. And they divided along the lines you'd expect, which is some of the more, you know, philosophically oriented Republican students lined up behind Paul, whereas the sort of political activist sorts who were looking at, you know, careers in the state legislature tended to be more with Grayson.
There are some, and of course opponents of Paul would say that his ideas are way out there, and I've heard interviews with people who planned not to vote for him because they thought that they were so way out there that he couldn't be possibly effective in the U.S. Senate.
You know, you heard a lot of the same things about Ronald Reagan when he wasn't president, and obviously he was able to go on and become president, and it continued to puzzle people even when he was politically successful. They do these polls, and the voters didn't agree with Reagan, and yet when you got to the question of do you like the job Reagan's doing, do you plan to vote for him again, they said yes. It's easy to overestimate how important issues and ideology in that principled sense will sway voters. Sometimes they'll take someone who has clear principles, some of which they disagree, over someone whose principles they can't identify and therefore that they consider unpredictable.
And what was Paul campaigning on? What were the main issues?
Well, you know, his open message was very bookish, really. If you listen to his speeches, it was very traditional. You know, the Federalists who believed in limited national government and you know, not having government do more than its necessary functions of protecting us from, you know, crime inside and enemies outside. He sounded a lot like a laid-back civil liberties professor most of the time. Someone, you know, in the tradition of John Locke, it was not, you didn't get a lot of stump speeching. There's not a lot of fire. It's very, you know, he sounded like he was trying to be a teacher.
Well, that usually doesn't rally the voters.
No, no. And, you know, he so far he's been lucky, right? He's preaching to the choir. They don't necessarily have to understand the words or think about them very much because it's consistent with the themes that these Republican primary voters have endorsed over and over again. Now, you know, he's got to take that message on the road, and he's going to have to sell it to people for whom the message is less familiar and it isn't just a cliche that's been rattling around in their background. And so he's, you know, he's going to have to be a compelling teacher if
right.
he wants to bring the electorate with him.
Right. Turnout, how was it?
It was not atypical, and it was near what we expected. You know, the Republican registration is not terribly high here, so a lot of people have made a big deal of the fact that even the loser in the Democratic primary received more votes than Paul did to win his primary. So, you know, you're not talking big numbers that you could convert into an immediate victory by any means. But keep in mind, this is what's called a closed primary state, which is to say that the parties, you know, bully voters into registering as members of them if they want to participate in the early stages of the political decision. So what that means is a whole lot of these Democratic primary voters are not Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are independents. Some of them are sort of conservative, Southern-style Democrats who, when you move to the national political stage, are loyally Republican.
So take us ahead to the fall. What kind of race are we looking at?
Well, it's, you know, we have a fairly mainstream national Democrat here, you know, with a lot of positions that in Kentucky will be seen as liberal. And he'll be, of course, saddled to a Democratic president who is unpopular with a lot of the Kentucky electorate. And then on the other side, we have a fairly hardcore ideological conservative. So this is a very polarized race. And there are a lot of voters who will be sitting in the middle trying to choose between two positions that they consider somewhat scary.
Mm-hmm. And tell me what you think, if anything, Professor Voss, we can take from the broader picture here. If you combine what happened in Pennsylvania, what happened in Kentucky, and what happened in Arkansas, you learn what?
This is a trend that started in the mid to late 60s, and it just, you know, it pushes forward, and then it drops back a bit, and then pushes forward. And that is a trend toward the Democratic and the Republican candidates being more extreme and unrepresentative of the typical electorate. We used to have parties of compromise, and they try to come up with someone who represented what they stood for, but who could reach out to a wide spectrum of the electorate. These primaries and the role of money in them has pushed. Candidates more and more to the extreme. And when you see these moderate compromise Democrats failing on the one side, and you see the sort of technician-oriented compromise Republicans failing on the other side, you realize why our political system has become so divisive and so unsavory to, you know, the regular American voter.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would indicate to me that turnout in elections is going to keep getting lower because people seem to say they want more moderate politicians. So you just be appealing to the base, yes?
Yeah, it can come and go, though. You know, fear is a wonderful motivator. And, you know, you often will see elections where the turnout is high, not because the voters were particularly fond of either candidate, but because there were candidates that really worried them. So it can be high or low. Neither one's necessarily a healthy sign.
Mm. Thank you so much for being with us, Professor Voss. I'm sorry about our sound problems.
Well, I'm sorry if it was on my end.
No. Okay. Thank you. Professor Stephen Voss, our guest this 20 minutes. We had three guests this morning. It was a busy hour. From the University of Kentucky, where he is associate professor and director of undergraduate studies. And we thank him for being with us, along with all of our other guests. We started with Thomas Fitzgerald, staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Professor Janine Perry, political scientist at the University of Arkansas and director of the Arkansas Poll. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader, who's returned to help us out. Welcome back, John, for on-air production. And thanks, everybody, for your calls. I know it was hard to take a lot of calls this hour, but we wanted to get the results and the analysis of all of these races to see if they said anything about what may happen in the fall. I'm not sure it did say anything about what may happen in the fall, but that's interesting in itself, right? We have news coming up, and we'll return with more Thursday conversation.